Welcome to the Property Management Mastermind Show with your host, Brad Larson. Brad owns one of the fastest growing property management companies in San Antonio, Texas. This podcast is for property managers by property managers. You'll hear from industry leading professionals on best practices, new ideas, success stories, and lessons learned. This is your opportunity to learn about the latest industry buzz surrounding property management, as well as tips and strategies to improve your business. Now here's your host, Brad Larson.
Hello everyone, this is Brad Larson, host of the Property Management Mastermind Podcast. To see a complete list of the offers and discounts we have worked to provide, visit our website at propertymanagementmastermind.com. In there you will find additional discounts from Tenant Turner, Citizen Home Solutions, PMW Websites, and several others. Also be sure to check out our Seminar and Conferences tab, where we highlight different conferences going around the country, business and property management related. Lastly, be sure to seek out the Facebook group we have started and become a member. In that group, the PM community at large, to include vendors, are welcome to join. Hey everyone, I want to tell you about the upcoming conference in Atlanta, Georgia, called Pulling Back the Curtain, happening this January 2019. This is a two-day event with day one being presentation style of an exclusive group of property management entrepreneurs, followed by day two as small group sessions. Speakers include Dave Borden, Deb Newell, Mark Cunningham. My presentation at this event will be on closing business, discussing sales tactics that have helped us grow by adding more than one door per day for the last 2 years. Visit the propertymanagementmastermind.com site to learn more. In today's interview, I have Kelly Tollison coming in, and she's out of Seattle, Washington, and she's also soon to be the incoming NARPM president in a couple of years. That should be 2020 when she gets into that realm. So she's a great resource to talk with about security deposits. And so our conversation today goes in pretty deep about how to handle security deposits, what's going on in the country, where things are going to be slip through the cracks necessarily, and then how to deal with everything in the full life cycle of security deposits. So it's a great conversation. She teaches a class for this in NARPM. So you're going to learn quite a bit, and I hope you enjoy. And welcome everybody to another edition of the Property Management Mastermind Show. I'm your host, Brad Larson. And today's guest, I have Ms. Kelly Tollison coming to us out of the Seattle, Washington area. And so one thing we have in common today for sure is I'm in rain here in sunny San Antonio, and she probably is as well. How are you doing today?
Hey, Brad, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on your show. And we're not raining yet, but we're cloudy. Definitely.
It's coming. Don't worry. It's coming.
It's coming. Definitely. Yeah.
We've had a wet fall this year. It's been awful. So it's definitely one of those wet years. So we could use the rain. Otherwise, we're in drought, you know, all that good stuff.
You guys got the extremes, rain or drought.
Totally. So what we want to do real quick is I want you to give a quick intro about yourself and your company to give some people some perspective of what we're going to talk about today, which is all about security deposits. And this is something that you taught at NARPM. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed you and I said, we got to do a podcast because this is going to be really good stuff. Nobody's talking about this. And there's so many things that people have questions on. So please give us a little bit about your background to give us some context here.
Okay, great. So yeah, as you said, my name is Kelly Tollison. I own and operate T-Square Properties with my husband, Tom. We started in the business buying and selling our own rentals and then realized, wow, we could do this for other people and discovered NARPM around that time. And we've been in the business for over 20 years now. We've got about 14 employees. We manage about 450 doors and 64 homeowners associations for, you know, a little over $1.5 million in revenue every year. We also have a maintenance company that we developed about 2 years ago, or excuse me, 10 years ago. And that's been a really great kind of a bonus for us as far as when the other part of the business is ebbing and flowing. The sister company that we have usually does a really good job.
Are you guys having a big sell-off this last year like a lot of the markets have?
Right. So we can use that maintenance company to work on some of the handyman work for our association that we manage. And then some of the turns, you know, that we do, all of the turns pretty much we use our maintenance company for. You know, and you're only as good as your best technician. And we've luckily had a great guy for the last 5 years. We just promoted him to general manager and hiring new technicians. Got a cleaning person on staff. So it really ties everything together in the revenue area, having that on board.
That gives you a real clear understanding of the security deposit lifecycle, because when you have your own company, you understand the work being involved. It's also, it's often being supervised or executed by your team on that side of the fence. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a real good perspective. Now, you also taught the class in NARPM about security deposits. So essentially what I did is I wrote out about 12, 13 questions And I want to go right down that because that's going to spur talking points between you and I to pull out your expertise and to give my 2 cents worth and just kind of make it an open-ended conversation for the listeners, because this is really, it's kind of a topic nobody talks about, really. I mean, it's something that I think is of interest because it's an execution of the operations. But if you're not looking at it, you just don't even know what's out there. So topic one, first question is, how much security deposit should you charge? Should you plus it up? You charge 2 times or 3 times? When is that appropriate? Let's talk about the amount right off the bat.
So when we first started in the business, we said, well, let's just make it the same amount as rent, because we knew at the time we didn't want to do a last month's rent, so let's just make it the same. Well, that immediately caused confusion with the tenants. Well, I paid a last month's rent, so why are you taking why would I have to pay my last month's rent? I already paid it. So we immediately changed that, and we just dropped it slightly below the 1 month's rent. And that has been effective for us since the time we changed it back at the very beginning. Our market doesn't constitute a last month's rent, so we don't collect it. So we just put everything into a security deposit. We will up it when they don't meet our screening criteria. When they come in conditionally approved, we will double it. And that has worked really well until you jump into the city of Seattle, which I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about the city of Seattle, city of Portland as well. They put a cap on security deposits. In the city of Seattle, you cannot charge more than 1 month's rent, or the first month's rent, 1 month's rent, I guess they say.
Okay.
The verbiage is very loose, but it's very well enforced. So even if you have a conditional approval, there's nothing you can do. So what happens is the tenant loses out because they don't have the option to up their deposit. What the only option they have then is a cosigner. So it's either you fully meet the criteria or you don't and you get a cosigner. So that eliminates the whole middle part of the market that's looking for rentals because they don't have cosigners. We're not going to double their deposit. They just don't get approved.
Part of what we do around that, and this is kind of just a good idea for you, I'm going to throw out what we do, and this is fully up on our website. This is not anything that we're, you know, below board. But what we end up doing is we charge a risk mitigation fee. And so we scale people on their credit report rankings,
right,
and rent screener. And so let's say a combined couple comes up with a 557 credit score. We ended up putting, and it's really not a credit score, that's a tenant score, because they take into account their past rental history that's been reported into TransUnion. That tenant score, as you will, would incur a risk mitigation fee. And I'm not going to mention the numbers, okay, but it incurs a risk mitigation fee, which then allows us to only charge the 1 times deposit. One technique you could consider, and I'm not telling you how to do this, and I'm know it all here, but definitely consider that for Seattle and Portland and other areas. I mean, obviously managing Seattle, is to work out to where you could do a risk mitigation fee and then still charge the 1 times deposit. And you can decide where that fee could go. That could go to your office, that could go to the owner. I mean, there's no hard and fast rule. And we have 3 levels of that. And so, you know, I can go into the scores, but it's all kind of just whatever works for your market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go from X to X and that charges something. You can go from X to X and that charges something. And then the 3rd level is you go from X to X and that charges a little bit less something. So it can build up and escalate it. Now, here's where I'm going with this, is instead of a 2 times deposit, which is a huge barrier for entry into that particular home, the risk mitigation fee could be slightly, if not significantly smaller than a 1 month's deposit. So essentially, you could be charging a lot less for that tenant to get into the home, potentially leasing those homes faster.
Right.
Thrown out there.
So that's a great point. Recalling the whole law in Seattle, the move-in funds cannot exceed 1 month's rent. So you can't dress it up and call it something else if it exceeds 1 month's rent. So you could say you have that risk mitigation fee. You could say, well, let's say the rent is $1,500, which can't find that in Seattle very often, but $1,500 and your security deposit is $1,300, then your risk mitigation fee can only be $200. So your move-in funds can't exceed the 1 month's rent, whether you call it an admin fee or... Now, the pet deposit is separate, and that can only be can't exceed more than 25% of the rent. So your pet deposit can exceed the security deposit, but it can't exceed 25% of the rent. So they've capped it. So basically what they're trying to do is make it more affordable just to move in because the rents are so high.
Fascinating and dreadful at the same time.
It's all of the above. Yeah.
we don't really want to see that bleed east anytime soon, because that's really not a good thing for anybody.
Yeah.
Not good for owners and not good for managers and not good for tenants, because if they don't have enough skin in the game, sometimes they just don't take care of the property like that.
Right.
So here's another concept. You know, should or could you charge certain fees instead of the deposit? I mean, we talked about the risk mitigation fees, but what are, you know, animal fees? There's all kinds of stuff in there.
Right.
Processing fees. There's things that can be charged. And we're not going to mention numbers, but it's not going to hurt us to throw the name of the fee out there. No one's going to arrest us. So
I don't, you know, I don't think we're doing any earth-shattering business in the fee area. It's all pretty standard. The tenant admin fee. We have a fee, you know, not at move-in or move-out yet, but we're considering putting into play a work order management fee, where if we do have to create work orders at move-out because they didn't leave the house in rent-ready condition that was exceeds normal wear and tear, that would be attributed to the tenant, that we'll charge them a fee to manage that work. And then we'll do the work. The tenant charged for work. Now, of course, we don't charge the owner of the tenant the work order fee, but the tenant will be charged a fee just to process the work.
I like it. And we're doing the same thing. I think that's a smart thing to do at the end of the lease.
Right.
Deposits. You know, it's kind of our big thing for the day, because we're only talking, I mean, we're talking the life cycle, right? So we
exactly.
Talked about initial entry, but we haven't even got to scratch the surface yet of the full life cycle. So
right.
Let me take this on a tangent just for fun. Let me know if you've heard of this technique. Apartment complexes are doing more and more of this, using a bond instead of a security deposit. So essentially, they're paying a fee to get into a pool of bond money. So let's say security deposit fee might be, let's say, or the security deposit required to rent an apartment might be $1,000 for fun. Just nice, even figure.
Okay.
Their bond might be $175, and it's a fee. And that money goes into a bond pool. And so if there's any sort of claim at the end, that comes out of that bond pool of money. So this is you know, again, we're always chasing the multifamilies as far as what they're doing.
As far as fees go, yeah, absolutely.
We always are chasing them. So I thought that was very fascinating to see that the bonds coming up as far as a bit more. You know, we just hired a young lady that's going to come into our office and be a leasing coordinator. So she's going to handle all the leasing side.
Uh-huh.
And if she's leaving to come work with us, that's what they're doing. They're doing this bond thing, and I'm like very fascinated with it. I want to find out more.
Yeah, I'm curious. How do you make a claim on the bond? I mean, how does that? Do they just pay it out, or do you have to show substantial of everything?
You got to show the work that was done. You got to show the proof of pictures, and they just probably pay it out like an insurance claim with all the proof involved that ties into your security deposit itemization at the end.
Interesting.
I thought that was very interesting, and so. Think about that even further. What if you could all of a sudden, instead of charging your tenants, you know, $1,500 to get into Seattle, you charge them $250, right? Would that not rent your homes a lot faster? Potentially?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah.
And then you could even upcharge. So we do receiverships. When an association takes over a unit of a homeowner that hasn't paid their dues, they can legally go in and acquire the unit, if you will, and then we step in and we're appointed by the court as the property manager to lease the unit, and then we send the proceeds to offset the amount that homeowner owes the association for their dues. We're required to get bonds, and the bond I'm getting is $100. So you could upcharge that to a tenant, make it a source of revenue, and then they wouldn't be out the funds. I wonder if the bond company would do it for security. They must be if the multifamily's doing it.
Yeah, it must be. And I'm curious if they do an option. Like,
yeah.
They give you the option to pay like $250 for a non-refundable bond. It's basically a fee. Or you would pay a security deposit that could be refundable at the end,
yeah.
Depending on the condition of the home.
That could be market changing, especially in areas like Seattle and Portland. And I'm sure there's places in California that have the same laws.
Yeah, so I'm very curious to find out more about that. I would just imagine it's only a matter of time before that starts to bleed into the single family home space, because if they're doing it multifamily, they're going to be doing it in single family homes.
Well, then you wouldn't have those disputes.
Correct.
All of us can attest to that.
The tenants are cut and run at that point at the end because they've already paid their fee. And I'm sure that fee can get pretty large. I mean, let's say it's a $1,500 deposit. That might be a $500 bond fee that's gone versus, you know, putting it at risk there, you know, $100. It could care less than, right? So I'm sure it's about a third to a half of the actual security deposit, but then they don't worry about anything at the end, which almost encourages them to leave the home in worse condition. I mean, you could, we can spin that argument.
Yeah, it would, but at least you'd have the funds to cover it. And then if you have a maintenance company, you have the work to do it, right? Then your maintenance company is going to benefit.
one of the basics. This is property management 101. What form of security deposit do you take?
So we take the security deposit upon exchange of keys. The tenant usually signs the lease electronically before they come in. We have them. We go to the property one time, well, to show it. And then after that, we do the move-in condition report. And then they meet us at the office to sign or fully execute the lease at that point. Then we collect a cashier's check or a money order. It has to be negotiable funds when we hand over keys. No questions asked. If they can pay ahead of time, if they have the funds to do so, if it's 10 days prior to them taking the keys, so that we know the funds will clear. But if they exchange the cash for the keys, it has to be negotiable funds, or a cashier's check or a money order. So
pretty standard. So yeah. One of the things that I want to throw in there is we do a lot of our lease agreements. I mean, basically all of our lease agreements electronically. So uh-huh. You bring the tenants into your office and sign that in person?
No, they actually, so we kind of do it a little differently. We have them sign electronically as soon as we have the property or the lease is ready and all the screening has been done. We do not execute it until we've received their funds because our lease says we've accepted the funds. So what happens is we will execute it in person with them. So they have in their heads, yeah, I signed a lease, but they do not have an executed instrument. So if they were to back out, they think they've signed the lease and we would certainly execute it right away. But we have, our lease says that we've accepted funds and we haven't. So we don't fully execute it until they come in, sign the, our state law requires that a signed move-in condition report is attached with the lease. Mm-hmm. So we do all that when they give us the money. And then we sign the lease and do the moving condition report, signing, review and signing, and then keep.
Very good. Only minor differences with what we're doing.
Right.
We're in Texas, kind of the wild west of
right.
So they sign the agreements electronically. They can wire funds to us, and we require that immediately upon a lease acceptance, let's say, because that way that kind of holds the home for them. And we can take a security deposit via wire. We can take it via money order, of course, always cashier's check or something in person if they're going to come in. There's no personal checks. No
right.
And the other thing that's also interesting is if they're far enough out, we would even allow them to do a money transfer basically through our software, through AppFolio.
Right. Yeah. So
give it enough time, just like what you mentioned with the check for 10 days is probably a good rule of thumb. But that's why I wanted to bring up the forms, because that's, even people have the basic questions like, well, how do you take security deposit? Like, what form? I mean, do you take nickels and dimes, or what do you do?
So, yeah, we don't accept cash either. I always tell people, if you want me to take your cash, then you may not get your house, because I may be long gone by then.
So at what point do you demand the security deposit before moving forward in the lease? Is that prior to getting keys?
So a little bit different. We actually, as soon as they have, so one of the other laws that we have to abide by that ties into this, is the first in line application process. So Seattle came up with this, as you receive your applications, you have to fully process it and either accept or deny that applicant and then take the next one. So you can't have two applicants side by side. So we decided to adopt that company-wide just to keep it simple. So we didn't have to say, well, is this a Seattle property? Is this not? Because we do manage in both in all different areas. So with that, the security deposit, we have a holding deposit. So there's four things that someone has to turn in order for us to consider it a complete application. It's the written application, the holding deposit form signed, then the holding deposit funds, and a copy of their photo ID, their government-issued photo ID. So we already have half of the rent by the time they come and sign the lease. We consider it some sort of very similar to earnest money. So if they don't get approved or in our screening, we give them the holding deposit back. If they are approved or conditionally approved and they accept the conditions, those funds are applied to the security deposit. So we're not sitting out there for a week without the funds, without them having some skin in the game and some risk if they don't move forward.
Fascinating. Gotta love the blue state mentality. So do they do that with homes that you're selling? So if I'm selling a home, do I have to accept the first offer in the door that meets everything?
No. Oh,
only for leases. No. Oh, I get it.
No, and it's only the Seattle market. And actually the first in time or first in line thing was appealed by the landlord advocates and they won, but now the city of Seattle is appealing back or asking the higher courts to take a look at it. So we've just decided we err on the side of caution and we've just decided to maintain the first in line policy. we think it's probably going to go back, but so we're just kind of, we don't want to get caught up in it. We don't want to be that test case that when it does go back, we're still getting caught up. So
you are spot on with that. I mean, do what the laws say. I mean, that's also one more reason folks are going to come to you for management services. So look right. at it kind of like a blessing. So I can pick on you because it's not your fault, right? This is not right. something I have arguments with Bart Sturzel and Todd Ortscheid, a couple of the guys that are on the folks and a couple of ladies. And we always say first in or best applicant, first in, best applicant. There's always this big riff going on. And I'm a best applicant person. Right. Our company is. So naturally, we don't sit on applicants for weeks. We sit on applicants for a number of hours.
Right.
And if we get two applications in, well, naturally, you choose the best applicant.
Right.
And I'm sure that's what you'd love to do. But City of Seattle says, nope, you got to do it this way. And so you being good managers, you're in full compliance with that. So it's really not your fault. I'd be very curious to watch that legislation and see how it goes through the appeals court to see if that's going to
do that. Kind of, you know, it kind of takes the burden off in any fair housing. So you have two applicants and you pick one because, you know, they have better, 10 points better credit, or they have been in their job a year longer, everything else being equally the same. In fact, it could be that the one you didn't pick is a protected class and comes back to you because you discriminated. We don't ever have that off. We're not in that playing field right now with that, with the first in time.
I get it. But you don't get to represent your owners the best you can because you have to choose.
Correct. Correct. But they still have to meet our screening criteria. So what we did actually is we upped our screening criteria. We used to have 2.5 times the income had to be verified. As soon as they did first in time, we bumped it to 3. We said you have to have 3 times the income. Verifiable, you know, gross income.
That's a great idea to equalize that mandated law that you've been forced to accept.
It's interesting because these tenant advocates think that it's all about making it easier for the tenant, but what they're doing is they're causing reaction in the marketplace to make it more difficult. So now instead of 2.5 times the rental income and being able to pick my tenants, you know, the best in line, right? Best of the best. Now they have to make 3 times and a lot of them won't qualify now. So they've just eliminated more of the market for themselves.
And I would also assume that some of the landlords are thinking like, screw this place, and they're selling and they're buying homes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was at my King County chapter meeting yesterday, and one of our local attorneys is a very big advocate for the landlords and represents us a lot of volunteer hours and so on, who has his own rentals as well. He told us he sold all his rental properties in Seattle and he bought outside of the city, different buildings.
Because they want to provide quality housing, but when you run off all the landlords, guess what? You're not going to have much good quality housing left. Again, I just don't buy that. But you know, on the positive side, let's think positive for management companies. Anytime they come up with these crazy legislation ideas, this turns us into more of a opportunity for us to get more owners that come seek out our services.
Absolutely, yes.
You look at again. Australia is another one I always bring up. You know, they're very tenant friendly. I mean, they joke that tenants are a protected species. I mean, like an endangered species over there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So they get a 75%, you know, penetration rate into the markets. And it's the mindset of if you're at a cocktail party and there's 5 landlords and you're the one landlord who doesn't employ a property manager, they look at you like there's something wrong with you.
Right.
What's wrong with you? Like, why don't you employ a property? Are you crazy? And so that's their mindset versus here in the States, it might be 2 or 3 that employ out of 5. Right. Really kind of interesting. But
well, when the Seattle stuff started coming down, there were property managers that said, I'm not managing there anymore. You know, not the ones in the city, of course, but ones that are outlying and could go into that area as well. And we said, send them to us because we're prepared and we're educating ourselves and we're staying on top of everything. So we're happy to do it. And we've got the systems in place to make it successful. So yeah, I agree. It can be a positive for a property manager, definitely.
Now, do you guys do leasing only?
We do, yes.
Okay, this brings up another fun topic of what do you do with the leasing-only security deposits? Okay, so let me start this off, and you can kind of tell me the differences of what you guys are doing.
Okay.
So we offer leasing-only services. Basically, we'll market the home, we'll screen applicants, we'll help them draft a very, very basic lease agreement, but then all funds have to be made out to the owner of that particular property, and we just thank you. Here's the check or the money order. And we hand it to the owner with a copy of the lease agreement and then say, here you go, sucka.
Okay. You know,
for you. Because here's the thing. If we cash that security deposit, now we have to 1099 the owner. And so we don't want to do that because a lot of times they'll give you a fake 10 or they won't give you honest information or whatever. these leasing-only landlords, they tend to be very shady. And it's we've actually upped the leasing-only fee to try and discourage them. I mean, they're right there to the point where our base member, our base plan is just a hair above the leasing-only. So we're trying to get them to do our base plan.
Right, just a turnover. Yeah.
But there's some that want to do it themselves forever and ever. And so we do, all right, great. You know, we'll collect the first month's rent and security deposit, and it's all going to be written out to the owner in a cashier's check. So that way, none of that funds flows through the company.
Right. So we do the leasing only, but we haven't had what you refer to as kind of flaky people doing it. They're legitimate landlords that just, and we have a lot of repeat lease ups that they'll come back after the tenant we place moves out. But we run it all through our client trust checking account. And we do 1099 them. I have to go back. It's been, you know, since last January, we 1099 them, but I have to double check that we do. I'm not sure we do actually on the lease up only.
Yeah, it just created more opportunity for us to screw up the 1099s because it just takes one and you're getting fined and threatened. And then you got one non-responsive leasing only owner who's coming out of the country or whatever, and they could care less. So yeah, we just stopped doing that. So the simple way is to do a straight pass through of nothing in our name, and we physically take the cashier's check and give it to the owner with a copy of the lease. We did all our marketing things for you. We got you a good tenant. We signed
so
your basic lease.
You get payment up front.
Correct.
That's one of the things that we like. We like to be able to hold their funds to take our fees and then give them what's left over.
Here's the other thing. We always now charge the entire leasing fee up front to the owners because you get the shady owners. Again, this is shady owner, shady C-class landlord territory where they want to come in, employ us, and say, yeah, go ahead and lease the home for me. And then guess what? They go figure out a way to find the tenant, and they find the tenant, and they execute a napkin lease agreement.
Right. Yeah.
Guys, I'm not paying you guys any longer. I already found the tenant. We've had that numerous times. I mean, just driving me nuts.
And yeah.
So, shady landlords out there that are really awful, and or C-class landlords. So basically, we take our entire fee up front. We used to do half, and even then, they'd stiff us.
Yeah. So can you customize a lease for them? Because we use our regular lease. We just don't have our logo on it. It's just a lease up only lease, and it's no logo and no reference to T-Square except for that we're an agent for the owner.
We took our custom lease agreement, which is Trek approved. My attorney approved it. We took that custom lease and we dumbed it down. I mean, completely removed all the stuff that makes any sense to, you know, like there could be certain things that only apply to when we work with a tenant. So we dumbed it down to like 6-7 pages, and that's the one we'll execute on behalf of an owner. It's a basic, solid lease agreement. The attorney approved it and all that.
So
we start getting into Texas real estate or even any state promulgated forms on a leasing-only situation, it implies a lot of management along the same lines because at the end, I'm going to make a point. At the end, guess who's still on the hook for the security deposit if that owner screws it up? Well, we can. I mean, it doesn't mean a tenant could not drag us into a lawsuit.
Right, it
was all over the place in that lease agreement. Like, this is... Right. This is not ours. We do nothing about the security deposit. We know nothing about security deposits. We just give you the money and you guys figure it out. And so we custom wrote in a bunch of that language to discourage, because here's what they love to do. Tenant gets stiff on their security deposit by a crappy C-class landlord, leasing only person. And they appeal to the courts and they say, well, who drafted the lease? BrentWorks drafted it. Well, good. We're going to drag them into the lawsuit and they're going to have to pay up. So to avoid all that, we inserted a lot of language into those leasing only deals.
Right. Okay. That makes sense too. And if you separate yourself further away from that landlord, then the less likely that you'll be drug into anything bad.
Hey everyone, this is Allison DeSaro with Seacoast Commerce Bank. You may have heard about us, or you may have even heard my podcast episode with Brad Larson, where we discuss the benefits of banking with property management bank like Seacoast Commerce Bank. We specialize in providing the ideal banking partnership for not only your business, but specifically your trust accounts. In addition, we offer a significant analysis program, which allows us to not only offset your bank fees, but then also offset property management related invoices. You can visit us at our website, or you can call me directly at 619-988-6708.
This is Brad Larson, and I endorse this message. Great opportunity here to talk about trust account funds, audits, and reconciliations, because you're in a high regulated state. Talk to us about what you end up having to deal with about your trust accounts and regulations and all that.
Right. So we have one client, what we call the client trust checking account, and that's where all the operating funds, some would refer to it maybe as your client operating account, and that's where money, rent comes in, all the expenses go out. And then we have a separate security deposit trust account. It has to be labeled trust account on the, by the bank. So if anybody were to see a bank statement, if it didn't say trust account on it, we'd be in violation. We have a whole RCW, which is the Revised Code of Washington, just related to trust accounting laws. So we're required to do what we all know is called the triple tie out. We actually have a spreadsheet that we created on based on what the auditor brought in about 4 years ago. We took what they were calculating, because you can pull up a lot of that software and they'll say, well, let me really see what does your software really say about your owner balances. I know your triple tie out or your bank account and your reconciliation report says it, but let me pull it up and see just to make sure. And so I do that in our company. I do it every 10 days. And what I found is that it helps me to figure out where there are mistakes made in a 10-day period as opposed to a 30-day period. So I don't, if I just do it once a month, it's harder to go back and say, well, where's that $500 that isn't showing up and not triple tying out? So if I do it every 10 days, it's just a lot easier. I know some people out there reconcile daily. You can reconcile as often as you want, but if you don't make sure that your owner balances are the same or your tenant liabilities on the security deposit side is the same as what you actually have reconciled at the bank, then you're not doing your triple tie out. So we're really diligent about it.
You have to be ready for an audit basically anytime, right?
Every day, yeah.
Your state can walk in and say, show me your books, and you
yep. got
okay.
Yeah, and our books are clean. I did at the convention, there was a vendor there that does bookkeeping for some of the companies that have some of the more popular softwares that we're all using. And I pulled up our database, and they said, wow, you're all good. There's one gal that did it before me, so she got the $100, but yeah, they were having a contest.
So let's talk about something that's kind of a hot button for us too, is are you allowed to do anything with that trust fund? Are you allowed to purchase CDs? Are you allowed to move it in money markets? You are. Okay.
So we are with the operating account. We're allowed to collect interest as long as it's disclosed to the owner. We don't have to pay it out. And we're allowed, so we take a portion of that operating account that we don't need and we put it into a money market account. We don't put it into CDs because we need it to be liquid right away. And we want to have it accessible in case we need it. So we just put it in a money market. It makes a little bit more interest. But one of the things that we've switched to, which I don't know, I know it's been out there, but we just recently switched, is taking the credit analysis at your bank and turning it into cash, so to speak, where you, rather than having the credit analysis and those actual credits that the bank accumulates, my bank, and I know there's a really big popular bank throughout NARPM that does it. And if you submit invoices to her in your accounting world, they will reimburse you back for those. So you can actually reduce your expenses if you bank the right way.
Right. And I'll go ahead and drop their name. That's Seacoast Commerce Bank, and that's Allison DeSario. You can get in touch with her at Seacoast Commerce Bank, and she's the one that can assist you in setting all this stuff up. And the analysis part you're talking about, we use Seacoast Commerce Bank, and not every state can use them, unfortunately, because there are just certain states like Florida.
Right.
That they want to keep the money in-house.
Right.
It's a virtual bank, but it does very, very well. They know exactly how to set up trust accounts. They're super good. And then that analysis stuff, that pays for a good chunk of what we want to do.
Big chunk,
$1,000, $1,500, $2,000, maybe more a month in basically credit for invoices. So it'd pay for your software. Anything recurring, like a website or anything like that you have recurring, they can pay for those invoices and just keep. It's a really neat, slick deal, and it's much more than interest gain.
Right, absolutely. Way better than the interest gain, yeah.
Here's another interesting spin on the trust account funds is, for example, here in Texas, I know a property manager who has a couple million in trust. They pull that out at a certain level. They always keep maybe like $100,000 liquid in the bank, but they pull out the balance of that and put them into scaled CDs, like escalated, staircased CDs. And they're getting some pretty good returns. I saw, for example, with American Express, you're looking at 2.5% to 2.6% returns.
Wow.
Express. Now, we're not doing this yet. I don't know exactly what the laws are going to state here in Texas. I know they don't state, you say you can't do it. I'm pretty sure you just want to check it out with your own attorneys in your own state.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, in the state of Washington, we're allowed to collect the interest. I don't think, like I think in California, they're not allowed to collect the interest and they have to actually pay it back if they collect it. So that'd be a nightmare to me.
Yeah, but they can also start their own title company in their garage. So, yeah. You know, I don't feel bad for them because they have other ways to make money. They start their own escrow companies reap funds out of the title policy that way. So we don't have that opportunity. They do. And so if they can't collect interest on security deposits, too bad.
Right.
So let's talk about the end of the lease, because this is where the rubber meets the road a lot of times. Right. Getting done with those security deposit itemizations, that is a real big bugger. So at the end of the lease, tenant moves out. Let's talk through your inspection processes.
So we have our leasing team will be the ones that usually go out. We don't have a specified inspector to do this. So our leasing team goes out, makes the punch list, and then they coordinate, because we're departmental, they coordinate all of the repairs with the owner and then through our maintenance coordinator with the owner's approval if it's not tenant charged. So we get that all processed through. And in the meantime, they're working with a new tenant coming in, so they know the timing of the rent ready work and the new tenant moving in, and it just keeps it all nice bundled up in one little package with one person. And then we send out the deposit disbursement, security deposit disbursement out to the tenant. We try to be as transparent as possible. We don't send them the report, but we send them the written part of it. We use one of the apps that are out there that are support NARPA. So we send the written part of it, but we don't send all the pictures. So we send all of that out with any money that they get back. We have this really cool spreadsheet that one of our people developed a few years ago that says, you've left the condition in great shape, here's your deposit. You left it in medium shape, here's what you get back. Or you left it in bad shape and now you owe us money. You know, more diplomatically than that. So that goes out to the tenant and we itemize it there. We include invoices. We're not required to. But we do anyway, because they're going to argue with us, we know. So we include those invoices. And then even if it's a proration, so let's say, for example, we had to paint one of the rooms in the house, but we ended up painting the whole house. You have one invoice, then we itemize on that particular invoice. We'll say that you have prorated this amount for this room kind of thing. So we do it all in one packet and we send it out. And generally, one of the things I've learned is the way our bookkeeping accounting works is we've started sending screenshots of what we charge the tenant to the owner when we send it out. Because the way AppFolio does it, and I don't know if any other software does it this way, is you get one big drop of income, let's say it was a $2,000 security deposit, into the owner's account, and then they see all the bills. What they don't know is what was the tenant actually charged for. Even though they got all the bills, it might have been a proration or something. So we're starting to just send a screenshot. Here's what we charge the tenant, but you'll see all the financial activity on your statement. But here's what was taken from the tenant.
What kind of proof are you guys looking at when you go out there? Are you doing just an inspection format like a Z inspector?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we're doing it and that whole software systems will give you the pictures before and the pictures after, and we sit down in the office. So whoever's doing the move-out inspection is simply documenting the condition.
Are you doing a move-out video?
We don't do videos. We take pictures, still pictures.
Okay.
We haven't gotten to the videos yet. I know some of those software apps will allow for videos, but the pictures have been working really well for us, so we haven't really switched. But we don't do the move-out inspections with the tenants. When they ask, we generally will say, we're going to be there sometime on this day. We've got 6 of them to do. We don't know when we're going to be there. And yeah, we tell them, simply it's just a documentation. There's nothing you're going to be able to do. The one thing, Brad, that we've really learned, and I know you kind of like, ooh, you don't want the tenant there. You don't. But this is the final touch point of your experience with this customer, if you will. And if you can do anything that fits with your business model and your company values that will provide a better feeling when they leave in that last touch point, then you've done your job. I mean, we are service providers in the end. Yes, we have to do shared responsibilities, but if I can have a tenant without compromising my structure and my business, my people too much, where the tenant is happy when they leave, that's my end goal, right? But I'm not going to just give them money because that's going to make them happy. I'm still going to follow the law and do all those things. So we tell them, you're welcome to show up, but this is what's going to happen when you get there. You've already surrendered the property, so you're not going to be able to do anything to it. We're not going to tell you what we're going to charge because we don't know, because we're just documenting, and then we're going to go back to our office and make the comparison. But you're welcome to join us. And most of the time they come.
You've already set the stage by that point, and I do not see that as a problem. If you've already set the stage, and then your maintenance coordinator who's actually doing the walkthrough is got a good spine and is not going to be bullied by a tenant.
Absolutely, yeah.
You should be fine. I think that's not a bad technique at all. So a couple of interesting things I want to bring up is you show invoices to your tenants.
We do.
I've never had an invoice presented to me for the burger I had at lunch, for the fries, the invoices for the fries, the invoices for the bun, the invoices for the cheese. I'm very curious, you know, how and why you want to do that, because that's always been just a needling point for us. You know, people think that they can see the invoices for the McDonald's lunch you just had.
Right.
How do you do? How do you break that down?
Well, so they accuse us of stealing their money, basically, or cheating them and saying, well, did you really spend that much? Because it seems super expensive to spend $300 on cleaning my house when I left it way cleaner than when I moved in. Well, really? So here's the invoice from the vendor. And here's the 5-page checklist that they use to move to do it. So we just kind of proactively say, yes, carpet cleaning actually costs more than your non-refundable, because we charge a non-refundable carpet cleaning fee. And if the actual carpet cleaning exceeds that, we take it out of their refundable. So yeah, we do. And we do, you know, so for example, a tenant thinks, oh, there's only 2 light bulbs. They won't charge me for that. Well, 2 light bulbs is $60 an hour in our market for a handyman, plus the light bulbs. So yeah, we're going to send them the invoice and we're going to say, this is what we did. And it's worked out to our favor most of the time. A lot of times they'll say, well, I could have gotten on Groupon for 40% less. Well, then why didn't you call Groupon before you moved out?
Exactly.
So yeah. I think in your market too, I think your market's landlord friendly. Ours is very tenant friendly, and they're very entitled set of people out there. And so we want to be very much on the offense and say, hey, we don't have anything to hide. Here's what we did. Here's why we did it. Here's the pictures if you want to see them, and so on. And we try to treat each of the tenants fairly. We tell them that we're really the referees between the landlord and the tenant. We're not gaining or losing anything by this determination. So here's what we did, and here's the results or the evidence of what we did.
One more thing to bring out on that. I'm going to tell you what we do as well after this, but
sure.
So the prorated charges, this is a learning point for everybody out there. So if we have to do any sort of paint or any sort of carpet,
right,
we prorate that charge on a depreciation scale. Now, correct me on the depreciation scale numbers. I'm doing this from the top of my head. Carpet, we depreciate at 7 years. Paint, we depreciate at 5 years. And that ties straight into the IRS guidelines. Is that something that you're familiar with?
Yes, I am. We chose the Master Builders Association, and I think they said carpet was 10 years.
Okay.
We may have to reevaluate that, because I think the products that's coming out today is not as quality as maybe it was 10 or 15, 20 years ago. So carpet isn't lasting as long as it used to. And then the paint, we do 5 years.
So here's how that works for everybody out there. So let's say you put in brand new carpet before the tenant moves in. The tenant stays there 2 years and destroys the carpets. Okay. So now that tenant deprived the landlord of 5 years out of those 7 years depreciation. So essentially you charge that tenant on behalf of the landlord 5/7 of the replacement cost of the carpet.
Right.
And that's completely fine. You can show the numbers and the IRS will buy off on that. And that way you are basically only charging the tenant for what the portion that they denied other people's use of.
Right.
And that's how that proration works. So same thing with paint. If they lived there for 2 years and they destroyed it, they denied the landlord a use of the paint for 3 years. Out of the 5, you charge them 3/5 of the replacement cost.
Right. I think we use the 10 years on the carpet because it's easier to divide 20% of something,
Okay. Yeah, we have calculators in Texas. They're really I do want to talk to you about the end of the lease inspection process for us, because this will maybe add something to the group, and this is nothing like we're super fancy or anything else. But so essentially, anytime a tenant vacates the home, the first thing we do is our portfolio manager goes to the home and gets eyes on, because they're the one that's preparing that make-ready itemization list you're talking about, and they're doing the security deposits. So they're getting eyes on. We do a third-party Z inspector inspection. Okay, that's just basically just a picture inspection like you might have heard of. But right. Our portfolio managers, while they're there, they're going to do a move-out video. Very easily done with your iPhone. You're looking at a 5 to 10 minute video. They can highlight the negative portions. They pop that into YouTube, and that's part of the evidence we use. So then the portfolio manager will get the make ready going. They'll work with the maintenance team, start initiating the make ready. Okay. Now it's time to actually start illustrating the security deposit itemization. So what we end up doing is we created a letter, and then we have, of course, the charges, the references, who's conducting the inspection, and then we include the YouTube. This is really cool. So we create a page on our website that contains every single address for the homes that have just newly been moved out, and every single link inside of that page is password protected. So essentially what we end up doing is we give the security deposit itemization letter to the tenants with a link to go to our website and a password to get into their exact address.
Okay.
And on that page, we present everything. We give them the Z Inspector inspection. We give them the video. We give them a copy of the receipts in there as much as we can.
Oh, okay.
Copy of that security deposit itemization. I mean, it's over the top evidence that you just can't provide in a letter. You can't put a video into a letter. And if you try to, link it somehow, it's gobbledygook. You know what I mean? That those YouTube gobbledygook. So we ended up put it on the website, and this has been working out fantastic. So all that aside, okay, we've got different techniques. They're all good. I'm glad we got a chance to cross-reference that. Let's talk about what happens if they want to refute one of these security deposit itemizations that you or I are doing. What's your process there?
So we have what we call a secondary review process, and this is what I've taught a little bit about around all the NARPM site chapters and so on. And basically, it's an opportunity, again, back to treating the tenant as a customer, giving them an opportunity to be heard and to tell us their point of view. Even though it may be way off base, they want to be heard. They're upset. They got their letter in the mail and they didn't get the money they wanted. So they want to have a place to go. So we created this secondary review process. And what it is a format. So the first thing we do is if they call, we say, well, we're really happy that you called us. We're definitely open to listening. We do have a process in place. Let me send you the form. If they don't want to put it in writing, then we know it can't be that big of a deal for them. So they have to put it in writing. If they send us an email, we'll say, well, we do have a process. We'll accept your email as part of the process. And here's the format of what's going to happen next. So we put this process in place, and we do. We have a team of people in our office that aren't associated with the move-in or the move-out, and they look over what the tenant is alleging is wrong. And from time to time, the tenant may be correct, and we may have overlooked something. As you know, there's at certain periods of the year, we have a ton of move-outs, and we miss things sometimes. So we're open to it. And our whole theory and philosophy is that we want to be fair and equitable between the tenant and the landlord. And if we did miss something, we're open to reviewing that. And then we follow it up with a really brief report, and we treat it as though we were going to go before a judge. So if the tenant says one thing, we dot point it and say, here's what we found. Here's the other thing they said, here's what we found. So if we had to, we could present that brief report to a judge. And then we go from there. We leave them an opening to say, if you don't agree with this, we'd be happy to meet in our office. And it's, a lot of times people will say, well, why don't you just send them the pictures and tell them this is what we found? And it's not about that. It's about the customer service aspect that we want to make sure that final touch point is they're treated with respect, they're treated fairly, and they go away. And the goal would be that they don't give us a bad review, but ideally, if they gave us a good review, it would even be better. But trying to keep them off of the social media reviews is one of the reasons why we created this system.
I like that technique. And here's kind of what we do in similar. Along the same lines in our security deposit itemization letter, one thing we do tell them, and this is in big bold, is do not come to the office. Do not call. We will not.
Oh, right. Yeah, you and I talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah, we will not discuss security deposits via phone and or walk in person.
Right.
Because that just puts you in a bad position and puts your staff in a really bad position. We also give them, just like what you do, an offer to refute. They can go in and fill in our 3 pages worth of stuff, and they can include pictures and attachments and invoices and whatever they can do to send that to us.
Right.
And we look at it just like what you do in a committee, and we have found things wrong. And here's the tidbit I want to throw at you. You and I briefly discussed on this maybe a few weeks ago, is once you have that, okay, hey, Mr. Tenant, we screwed up. We owe you $300. And so we're sending them basically a draft templated settlement letter prepared for by our attorney that includes a non-disparagement clause, which is allowed in a settlement, 100%. It's allowed in a settlement agreement. You can include a non-disparagement clause.
Right.
That's included in that draft settlement. Here you go, Mr. Tenant. Here's your $300 check. You sign this settlement agreement. We'll send you the $300. We can all go away happy forever and ever.
Right.
And so if you're going to give them something in return, you're going to get back something as far as some sort of assurance about the non-disparagement stuff. And of course, all the other settlement language that attorneys love to throw in there, that's going to be a part better. It's templated. We can fill it in anytime via PDF and send it to anybody. That's how you close out that security deposit in case they refute it. Just don't send a check and say, oh, have a nice life. They're going to just spank you on social media anyway.
Right.
Do that.
So, right. And we've implemented that form that you sent us. So thanks for that.
Good. I'm glad that helped you guys out. Again, that's attorney drafted. We had it approved. You know, all those things that we're doing are always run through the attorney. Just make sure we're up on the up and up.
Right.
So, okay, last thing we're going to talk about, because we're reaching, you know, a pretty good time here.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how you guys are handling negative reviews about security deposits. Yelp, social media, Google, you name it. How are you guys handling them?
So our approach is to not necessarily talk to the tenant that's disputing it, but I want the response to be to a future property owner to see how we manage people that come at us, right? So I'm answering it as though I want a future client to see it, and definitely tenants as well. But so our responses are generally, you know, we're open to all the feedback that you can provide. We don't kick back. We don't give them anything to argue with, really. We just say, thanks so much for letting us know. We'd be open to discussing this with you. I've tried to reach you 3 times or something like that. This is a concern for us. You know, we pride ourselves on our service and this doesn't seem like it turned out right. Or, you know, those kinds of things that just treating somebody with respect when we respond to those negative reviews. We don't post anything in a link to make them look bad. I've learned in the business that you always want to give someone an out. And that's something that we like to do is make sure that the person who, whether it's a tenant or a client or a vendor giving us a bad review, to treat them with respect and let them know that we're open to hearing what they have to say.
Good. So. Good technique. I mean, that's a very politically correct, good technique. There is no right, wrong, or other here. On the flip side of that, we are a little bit more aggressive. We label those reviews as outgoing tenants. I mean, that's the first thing we put on there on a response in Yelp or Google or wherever. Big, bold letters, outgoing tenant. And then we start to go from there on that. I mean, if they spew a bunch of lies about us, you know, we refute those. You know, we just don't roll over and say, oh, we're so sorry. Please forgive us, you know.
Well, I'm not saying we roll over, but we...
I'm not saying you are either. I'm not saying, I'm not saying you guys are either. But I can't stand that capitulation that sometimes you see with restaurants or other places.
I know.
Yeah.
And well, so, I think there's a lot of people outside of the industry, especially Yelp, that they don't hold a lot of credibility with Yelp. They, you know, yeah, restaurants are one thing maybe, but you can tell... When someone is, at least I can, the problem is that you have potential clients that are looking at your stars review and they're not going in and reading your filtered reviews or the ones that are really good. And they're not seeing the whole picture. And that's the problem is that they're saying, oh, well, you only have a 2-star on Yelp, so I'm not going to call you.
This is the craziest thing ever. Actually, one of the things we started to see trending in the last 6 months or so is when we do respond to those reviews and hammer the tenants back, owners that want to come in and sign with us love that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's very odd. I was thinking the same thing you were, Kelly, that, oh, we got to be very correct, very, very kind, very cordial, very professional. But, you know, when we hit back and throw some facts out there, you know, you get somebody that, for example, we had one that said we stole their security deposit because they didn't do this and that and the other.
That's pretty egregious. Yeah.
Yeah. We just say, well, look, we followed the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act to the T, right? And you left early. So, yeah, you violated the lease agreement.
Right.
You went against federal law. But according to your statements, we stole your security deposit and we're following federal law. So,
in a situation like that, we might come back at it. But, you know, I think every situation depends. But I think the main point for us, is I want to be responding to a potential client. What do I want them to see? What do I want them to read? What impression do I want them to have of my company? You know, do I go low or do I go high? And how do I, if I go low or if I kind of state the facts back. Am I doing it professionally? You know, that kind of thing. So
you guys are the consummate professionals. I really like that. So let's talk lastly about any new great things going on with NARPM. So I understand you're in the leadership realm. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So we've got one of the things that's really exciting that NARPM has instituted with our friend Bart Sturzel when he was president was called a leadership seminar kind of thing, a leadership classes that we've developed and that NARPM has invested in. And so this is our third or fourth year coming up in November. And what NARPM does is we get 2 days worth of leadership training. So the first morning is the RVP ambassadors, or excuse me, RVPs, and then the afternoon is RVPs and their ambassadors for a half a day of leadership training. And we have this really great resource of like a binder that comes with the position, and you get as a resource to look anytime, and it's also electronically on the website. And then that evening, all of the chapter presidents for 2019, well, so the next year, the presidents will come in. And then the first couple of years, we did just the presidents. What we've developed and opened it up to is the president and the president-elect. So for example, our president at King County for next year is Devin Easterlin, and the president-elect for next year is Liz Loop. So both of them will be coming to St. Louis to do leadership training. And what we found is we get depth of accountability. So let's say the president goes to leadership training and then just comes in and flops, doesn't do anything. Now we've got the president-elect that heard the same things and can help institute these things and get to a point where these chapters are becoming stronger and stronger. It's a really exciting time for the leadership to get not just tools that they can use in their chapters, but tools personally of how to be a good leader and that kind of thing. And I think that's one of the bonuses of becoming a volunteer leader is it's about growing and developing yourself as well as growing and developing your chapter. So I'm really excited about that in November.
You're in the high end national levels as well. So explain your current role at the national NARPM level.
So currently at our 2018, I've been serving as a national treasurer, which has been really a great opportunity to see kind of the inner workings of the organization that a lot of people don't see. Reading the financials, understanding the budgets and why we're doing some of the things that we're doing behind the scenes, and the investments that we're making. And then next year, I'll be serving as the 2019 president-elect with Eric Weatherington as the president. So excited about that. That should be fun.
Mrs. Vice President, let's say, right?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. And then, of course, the broker owner is coming up in 2019 in Vegas. In February this year, we weren't able to get a venue that worked for us in Vegas in April. So we had to go to the February date. So we're excited about that. That's promising to be a great event. We were able to shoot over the budget last year as far as we didn't spend as much as we thought at the last year's broker owner. So that'll be reinvested back into this year's broker owner, our 2019 broker owner.
That's really my favorite NARPM event is that broker owner. And it doesn't really matter necessarily what part of the states it's in, but as long as it's somewhere stateside, it's really great. Because it's such a small format and you get a lot out of it.
Right.
I really like that event. That's one of my favorites. Right. Of course, National is always a great event. I think you guys did a really good job this last San Diego visit. Of course, everyone's going to have grumblings, but I thought it was an outstanding conference. So keep doing. I hope to help with the golf tournament a little bit.
Good. Yeah, I noticed that.
My team went out and won the golf tournament this year.
Yeah.
San Diego, my foursome.
That's awesome.
Won that, and we were awarded a $6.99 house for that. It was
perfect. I understand the charity made over $50,000 for the Casting for Recovery, so that's terrific.
Very good.
And I know that the same people have been helping with the golf tournament, so I'm sure having you on the committee would be great.
Yeah, maybe next year I can win a sleeve of golf balls or some gym socks or something.
Were giving those out.
Well, Kelly, this has been a great episode because the security deposit stuff is something that nobody ever talks about. The ins and outs of how we do things in our two companies is going to, this might be a very good episode for a lot of folks to go back and reference because the stuff we talk about is gold in there. I mean, that's exactly what the Mastermind Show is built on is this would have been the same conversation of me getting on the phone with you for an hour and saying, how do you do this? And we do it this way. And we just bounce ideas off of each other. That's the format of this whole concept. So it's been a great episode. Any parting words before we can end this up?
I just want to say thank you to you. I appreciate what you're doing out there and getting the word out about how to be a great property manager and some of the different ideas. So kudos to you for doing this. And, you know, the Facebook page you have too is great. A lot of good conversations there. People throwing out ideas and exchanging great ideas. So I think it's great just to get more information out to become a better property manager.
It's really taking off. Appreciate it, Kelly. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Brad.
This episode of the Property Management Mastermind Show is sponsored by Mark Cunningham of Grace Property Management. Now, Mark has created some amazing products for property management companies. We have implemented his systems and his business income streams into our business here, and I can personally recommend them. If you are in the property management business, I encourage you to visit their website, as you will definitely find a product that will improve your business. I know Mark personally, and just a small investment to pick up one of his golden nuggets could earn you a return many times over. To learn more, go to propertymanagementsystem.org, again, propertymanagementsystem.org, and to get a 10% discount on all of Mark's products, use the promo code BRAD, B-R-A-D.
This has been a podcast episode by propertymanagementproductions.com. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast, leave us feedback, and come back for our next episode.